So welcome, everyone. This is the beginning of a new series on the seven factors of enlightenment, which will include seven discussions in the interim weeks. And what to say? I intentionally brought this series on after the shadow series because I think it's very important to have an understanding of how we can use the seven factors series to our disadvantage as well as to our advantage. And if we have a good sense of how the mind, when it leans towards a particular motivating towards a particular motivation that sees something in it wants, that it inevitably will create its opposite in that lean. Now, when we talk about the seven factors of enlightenment, it's hard not to want to lean to get these things, to see if we can brew the right stew of these factors. And so we look at our situations, our lives, we look into our minds, and as we go through these factors, many of us will feel that we've come up rather empty of some of these factors. At least they might be scarce. And we might wonder how to access these things. And we might distort our lives in such a way that we can try to make these states arise and become frustrated when they don't and become annoyed when the counterbalance or the counter mind state might be arising. And all of that annoyance and bitterment is actually the very stuff that keeps these states from arising. So we have to be more intelligent than that, especially when we go into these states one by one. Think of them not as the spices that you put into a soup prior to the finishing of the soup, but rather that the spices are already in the soup. And you can't take them out. You can't extract spices from a soup once they are stirred in. But if you have a very refined taste, you can actually taste perhaps some of the spices that you put in the soup by tasting the soup as a whole. So too, the seven factors are not thought, should not be thought of as being a piecemeal approach to spirituality. It's time for me to put a little more calm. I need a little more energy, a little more equanimity. We're not peppering and salting and flavoring our soup. So I try to stay away from the word cultivation during this series. Cultivation is very much a sense of the soup needing more seasoning and doing all we can to bring that seasoning to bear on the soup. And we get lost in the forever of time. We get lost in the sense of being deficient in a particular quality. And that just goes and reinforces the inevitable unworthiness that most of us carry with ourselves anyway. So I would rather think of these states as how to arouse them rather than how to cultivate them. Like in a soup, how do I taste this particular spice rather than how do I add more of that spice to the soup? Now, these states are very interesting because there are three states, three factors that are energy arousing and three factors that are very subdued and calm in their energy, and one factor, which we will talk about tonight, that you might say is the water of the soup itself that holds all of the spices together, and that's the factor of mindfulness. So this first talk will be around mindfulness, but I just want to carry on a little more about the seven factors before we get into that topic, because the factors are factors of mind, and they are the factors that, when they're in balance, lead towards the clarity of insight so that we see, awareness sees beyond the identification with the mind. So you might say it's kind of paradoxical that there are certain qualities of mind that allow awareness to see beyond the mind as an identifying, beyond its identification with the mind. And yet that is the truth of the situation. It seems as if we are continually clouded in our vision and our perception. And we come up time and time again to the limitations of our insight. And for us to begin to understand that insight is really an impersonal quality. It's not that you're needing to energize yourself or take yourself in control and force your control upon your spiritual endeavor. It's much more harmonious than that. It's much more innocent than that. It's much more natural than that. And in the course of these weeks together, speaking about these topics, this topic, I hope you get a sense that there's nothing more most of us need to be doing than what we're already doing to cultivate these qualities. Perhaps a little more effort, perhaps a little more energetic focus. I don't know. But you'll begin to see that these things are being cultivated in your daily life if you are sincere in your practice. You might say that sincerity is the fire that boils the soup and brings the spices into balance. I'm sorry to prolong this metaphor too much, but bear with me here. Because nothing really happens without sincerity. Now, where does the sincerity come from? Maybe we should start there. Where does sincerity come from? Sincerity comes from sort of bottoming out in your motivation to make life enjoyable for yourself. It's a sort of way we become drunk with the quality of the pleasant qualities of life that we have tried to wring from our living situation, and of course in doing so we also try to avoid the unpleasant qualities. Well, at some point that whole system, that whole strategy breaks down, and it just has a feeling that it's never going to work that way. It's just never going to, life is never going to work trying to avoid certain situations and enhance others. And so when it falls flat, that strategy, we just don't have any more energy for that strategy, then what arises from that insight, which is an insight, and much of the despair that we bring to practice is insightful despair. Despair that is not the tragedy of the person's failure to make life work, but the realization that life isn't going to work using this strategy. Then there arises in us a desire and an attunement, you might say, an attunement to hear the possibilities and potentials beyond that strategy. Then we begin to take our life seriously. And when we take our life seriously, we come into a spiritual teaching like Buddhism. We're often driven towards trying to uncover the essence of Buddhism. And that is really where the seven factors come in. Now, let me pause there and say that these seven factors, and we'll go through each one in detail in these coming weeks, there'll be a resonance, quite likely, with one of those predominantly for each one of you here in the room. I don't know what it'll be. Is it mindfulness? Is it equanimity? Is it energy? Is it investigation? Is it calm? I don't know. I don't know what drives your heart, where your sincerity wants to land. But oftentimes, each person has a predominant a predominant thrust towards one of these qualities. I can actually look at the teachers that I teach with and see in personality style what factor has been the predominant one in each one. For mine, for instance, is investigation. Now, we can access all seven of these factors from whatever is the predominant factor that we are most drawn towards. So, for instance, if your interests are, or your motivation is towards, say, mindfulness or towards, say, investigation, you can bring in all seven factors through that one factor if you use it in the right direction. So all the factors can come through a single factor's door. So that's important to remember. So as we go through this one, go through these, see if there's a resonance for you at a deep level. So that kind of a love of it, a love of doing it, a love of wanting to uncover what seems to block it, what seems to be enhanced when we focus in this particular way. And what you'll find is that it's not that the seven factors aren't available to you. It's just that we have put too much identification in what has blocked those factors. And when we can bring forth an investigative energy to look at what blocks those factors, that factor will arise in all of its glory. So which factor might you be drawn to? And as we also speak about these different factors, I don't want to completely discourage the attempt to try to arouse these factors individually. I think there's some usefulness in that. For instance, if your mindfulness isn't very strong, if it's just weak, and and there's a laziness, which is energy, which is one of the factors, and there's a lack of real care and attention, which is interest, which is another factor called rapture or happiness or joy. And if there's just not a willingness to really look at it closely, which is investigation, which is another factor, you see, then you're going to see that the lack of energy, in fact, blocks all the factors as well. Where do we want to access this? Where do we want to get this thing going? In the same way, as we provide more energetic response to, say, our mindfulness practice, the other factors come spin in a positive direction rather than bury themselves in a negative direction. So the factor of mindfulness. Now, while we're on this subject, let's just look at what is it that blocks our ability to be mindful? Mindfulness. By definition, knowing what's arising within experience is the definition of mindfulness. Knowing what's arising experientially, not intellectually, knowing what's arising directly, experientially. And we have all had the training within mindfulness. We've all set many, many hours on our cushion and perhaps practiced that mindfulness application in our daily life. And yet somehow it can seem very distant to us, very difficult, very burdensome, very tenuous in terms of our connection with it. What's happening there? Let's just be real straightforward in looking. What's happening is not that mindfulness is weak, it's that our own agenda is strong. We essentially place our own agenda upon the world and then try to operate mindfulness through that agenda. And that's just never going to work. It's never going to work to try to be spiritually in control of your life. That's an oxymoron. And we're still trying, you see, we're really working two strategies at the same time. We're trying to build ourselves up because we're still leaning towards trying to make our lives pleasurable and circumstantially beneficial. At the same time, we're trying to glean the essence of what life is. And so we're standing in front of the mirror, vainly flexing our muscles as we're trying to notice the essence of what this mind and body process might be. And we get lost in the muscle training rather than in the insightful piercing of the image itself. So mindfulness is stopped in its tracks because we want or fear too much from the world, and we're not able sufficiently to receive the world, because if we are to pierce and understand the world, which is the essence of what mindfulness is, then we have to be able to take the world in, receive it, to be able to see and learn from it. You see how, just follow the logic of it. Mindfulness is an attempt to go beyond the surface tension of the water to the depths of what the mind and process, mind-body process is. To do so, we have to be settled back in a receptive mode, in a learning position, posture. And if we are too focused on controlling events, we are leaning forward into life, away from that reclining posture that is the sense of learning. Therefore, mindfulness is interrupted or blocked or at best discouraged. And so we seem as if mindfulness just isn't working for us. Why? It's very simple. We're just not sufficiently, we haven't sufficiently bottomed out of wanting to be in control. So again, that bottoming out requires a kind of spiritual hunger from us. The way back in there somewhere, in your heart, the deepest recesses of your heart, there is a hunger for something more than what the world can offer. But as that hunger filters itself through the mental layers of our ideas, we try to fulfill that hunger through our desires, through the acquisition of life, through trying to reach out and grab life to make it what it is, rather than following that hunger to its source, which has nothing at all to do with acquisition. But the mind only knows how to interpret that hunger in terms of gain and ambition and pursuit. So we have to bring that hunger and orient it and align it in its proper direction, which is to see and understand the proper direction of that hunger in which it can actually be satisfied is in seeing and understanding, not in acquiring and possessing. And you begin to hear now the Buddhist teaching beginning to fold in to these states of and factors of enlightenment. They aren't just individual things out there that we need to that we need more of. We need to, if there is a job that we have to do, it's to orient ourselves in the right direction so that the aligned heart can access its deeper needs and deepest yearnings. And we just really don't know how to do that. We're lost. So let's look at this factor of mindfulness. Why do we start here? Why does the Buddha's seven factors of enlightenment start with mindfulness? Well, it's pretty obvious. Unless we see Unless we're aware, nothing happens. Unless there is conscious awareness. In fact, you might say awakening is awakening, making the unconscious conscious. That's what awakening is. The areas of our life that are mechanically conditioned are unconscious layers. And what we're attempting to do is to go in and to bring forth light into those darkened areas. We are making the unconscious conscious. Well, what does that do? What is needed in order to do that is awareness, mindfulness, awareness. The second thing, reason I think that the Buddha started with mindfulness at the top of the seven factors, is what I mentioned about the balancing quality of mindfulness, being able to hold all the other factors and nourish and cultivate or arouse those factors so that they can be in the right balance to one another. Mindfulness does allow, is the factor which does bring forth the other factors within itself. When you're mindful, when you're on top of what is happening, there is natural interest, which is a factor. There's a looking and an intimacy. There's a caring and a joy and a happiness in the self-discovery. Perhaps no greater happiness than the happiness of self-discovery. I'm sure that many of you have felt that before. When you're looking at yourself and you're seeing perhaps the most hideous thing about you, there's this quality of enjoyment and joy of just in the seeing, of being able to see it. And that's inherent in the state and quality of mindfulness itself. There's interest. There's energy. There's equanimity and balance in just the looking and seeing. So the mindfulness brings forth all of those different seasoned qualities within the soup. It also establishes us in time present, in present tense, because mindfulness is the arising of the presence, of the present. The other factors don't necessarily have the present tense. Investigation, you can be investigating something and not necessarily be in time and place here and now. So mindfulness has the ability to establish the axis of here and now for those other factors to arise within. Now, we have to be very careful because mindfulness, the job of it is to reveal patterns of identification and deceit, where we have essentially lied to ourselves, where we have misplaced our true journey, where we have misplaced the true strategy of life that feeds us to the greatest extent and nurtures us. We have distorted that through our mental wanting and fearing. And very quickly, we can use mindfulness to steer a distorted course as well. In fact, any of these factors, when they get enhanced with your own sense of vanity, will become distorting qualities, not enhancing qualities for your practice. So we'll talk a little bit about that in the course of the weeks together. Remember, though, that nothing can be done spiritually unless we see it, unless it is seen. It's not... I don't really understand how people can miss that central point in their life. That unless we look at the problem directly, experientially, face to face, that there's nothing we can do about it if it's just an unconscious knee-jerk reaction in the opposite direction. because we don't see the forces of the distortion. We don't see what we're doing to counter those forces. And we don't see the truth of what those forces are. So above all else, mindfulness shines the light of our attention so that we can see and so that something can be revealed. The other quality of mindfulness, which is extremely important, is that we have to bring the clearest and most pristine attention to bear upon ourself as we possibly can. That our mindfulness, and really the whole journey of our spiritual awakening, is to clean that filter of self-identification of thoughts and emotions, and all of the reactions we have when we see something, and all of the judgments that are occurring simultaneously at that moment in which we see something, and all of the story that is embellished within that seeing, all of that, none of that is mindfulness. Mindfulness does not feed the storyline of our life. It does not feed reactivity. If mindfulness is working appropriately, it is showing us the reactivity. It is showing us the story. It is showing us the points in which we are identified and lost. It is showing us the points in which we are in pain and hurting. And so our attention must be very clean so that we don't bring a whole sense of background identification and reactivity to what we see. What we are attempting to do is objectively see the subjective experience. And it sounds impossible, doesn't it? How can one be objective to a subjective experience? To your emotions. How can we see that emotion with any kind of clarity? We have to know that in order for us to be able to do that, we begin to see that awareness is sort of the substrata on which all states of mind have to walk. So that if we're focusing clearly on something without any judgment, then we are going to see the whole range of experiences that incorporate within that particular perception or event or experience. We're going to see, not only are we going to see the experience of pain or the emotion, we're all going to so be perceptive of any underlying link-up between the mindfulness and what it's perceiving, so that there isn't this watcher who says, gosh, this is really interesting. I'm really getting interested about this. This is so interesting. Look at this pain. That if I go over here, I can... See, that's all mind chatter. And if what we have to do at that point is to be even quieter so that the awareness can pick up the mind chatter, so that the lens can even become more clean, more pristine, and thereby see the mind chatter as something that is obscuring what it is that I'm trying to look at. It is in that way, it is in making the water of our attention wetter, that mindfulness begins to eliminate the underlying identification with the mind's experience. I feel like I'm losing you here. I just wanted to go there to show you how subtle awareness has to be in order to pick up the ways that the mind constantly tries to form a sense of self around itself. Most of us in practice begin at step one, which is that we are very identified with the watcher of our experience. We see, we look, and we feel like there's somebody back there who's watching all of it take place, all of the change, all of the different events that are occurring. At that stage of practice, which we all go through, mindfulness, we're very much in control of our meditation. We're very much in control of our mindfulness. We exert a lot of power and effort in order to be mindful. Mindfulness is something that we try to effortfully bring to bear upon events and experiences. It's this thing that we're adding to ourselves, isn't it? And when it's like that, mindfulness has a feeling of kind of not only a burden, but it's a cultivation. And I want to use that word very deliberately now, because it's like, okay, you know, there's a discipline involved, there's an endurance involved, there's a cultivation. It's just this thing that we're adding to our life that in some way complicates our life and doesn't allow us to go heedlessly the way we have always gone up until that point. Now, although it's the lens of our mindfulness isn't very clean at that point, there's a lot of identification that is still connected to our mindfulness, it's still the starting point for most of us. And for most of us in here, I'm sure, from time to time, we get involved in that sense of our spiritual work being a discipline, being something that we have to do. And the effort needed to do just that. It feels like we're very much in the controlling seat of this machine called mindfulness and trying to learn how to make the gears move properly and to stimulate the right energy and effort for mindfulness to work. But that's just the beginning. That's just the start of the practice. But I don't want to take that away. I don't want to dismiss it. It does require discipline early on. It does require cultivation. It does require effort to bring your attention back. And it feels laborful. It feels hard to do. Just acknowledge that. You're not doing anything wrong if that's the state of your practice. It's just that the conditioning that we're up against, the mechanical conditioning that we're up against, is so strong and so has such a huge momentum that mindfulness is just like a thin blade of grass in this giant step that will be squashed very easily. Slowly, that grass begins to grow and strengthen itself. We begin to be able to pick up reactive patterns that we've lived with our whole life, sometimes in the middle of that reaction, rather than 10 minutes after the reaction has occurred. And as we continue to practice discipline with labor, with effort, slowly we begin to make our lives more current, our mindfulness more current to the events that are unfolding as they unfold. The moment we feel irritation, we begin to notice that, not long after the irritation has manifested into anger and then into rage and we've lost ourselves. Slowly, over time, with patience, the mindfulness does seem to cultivate upon itself a strength so that it can stand up to some of this enormous conditioning that has driven our life up until that time. That's all within the range of what I would expect to be happening. So you're not doing anything wrong. But it's just a stage. And I'd like to move you into the next stage, or at least point to what the next stage may be, where it might be that can lead us. The next stage is where the mindfulness becomes so contemporary, so automatic, immediate to the situation at hand, that there is this relaxed composure that begins to you begin to abide in this kind of relaxed composure where you aren't in so much control of the mindfulness anymore. That it's just there, being present, showing you things that are passing in front of your eyes immediately, spontaneously as those experiences are occurring. At that point, we begin to see what it is that has been controlling the mindfulness. That's also passing in front of our eyes. All of the sense of me, my story, my drama, my reactions, all of my strengths, my weaknesses, all of that has become part of the mirror image of what I begin to see and acknowledge. And many of you have had experiences in that with mindfulness as well. There's a tremendous relief in not having to be so burdened by your spiritual practice at this point. There's a little bit of relaxation. You can begin to hear words like contentment, tranquility, ease, peace, relaxation. Not as states, desirable states in the future, but as actual indications of what's going on in you as you're practicing. You begin to see these states. And you begin to see how each state, a lure, is alluring, and you can get lost in them. But that what the real point of all of this is to have you settle back even further, release even more control, become even more receptive, and allow yourself to see even deeper the passing of the show of experiences in front of your eyes. The final stage of mindfulness is the stage of unfabricated awareness. Up until this point, there's been slight fabrication. I've been doing it to me. I've been making my spiritual journey work. At this point, there is the abiding in the natural play of awareness and presence, that we have released ourselves and our need to establish our own agenda, to be in control. And what the fallback position is now is just a deep abiding, a deep awareness. We might say that we have let awareness out of the closet of our control. We have released awareness to take its natural expression, to come manifest fully, and that we're no longer pretending to be the person who is doing it all. Now the awareness has come full circle, and mindfulness has gone from a fabricated pretension of control to the understanding and relaxation of just being. That's also within each one of our reach. This is not years down the line. This, again, will be determined directly proportional to your sincerity, to your urgency and need to discover yourself. How do we get to that point in which we feel sufficiently urgent to give ourselves over and away from control? We keep our eyes wide open to the strategies we're using while we're controlling. Because it is in seeing the limitation of our control that will bring forth that state of abiding. Not in reacting to that state of control or trying to cultivate the state of abiding. That's such an important point. You see, what it is that will free you up is mindfulness. What it is that will deepen your urgency and sincerity, what I call keeping your eyes wide open, is the awareness. Awareness in the beginning of practice, awareness in the middle of practice, and awareness at the end of practice. So I find myself setting my own agenda, tripping over my own feet, wanting to control everybody and everything. Don't try to change it. Keep your eyes wide open to what you're doing. Know what you're doing. know that that's, don't try to hide or deny or procrastinate or rationalize or any defense mechanism. Simply keep your eyes attuned to the strategies you're using. See the value you're getting out of them. See the limitation of what they will never provide and how much discord they cause within you and external in the events. Then awareness itself will begin to change you. You do not have to try to control the changing events so that you become more sincere. That's phony sincerity. Awareness itself, through the seeing of the strategies you're already using, will do all of the work for you. So I hope tonight's talk inspired continuation of wherever you are on the continuum of fabricated or unfabricated mindfulness. I hope it encourages the continuation of your discipline, of your cultivation or endurance, if that's where you feel you need to be. I also hope that you can look at what it is that you're doing and how much control you seem to be asserting on your spiritual practice and keep your eyes wide open so that you can move from wherever you are currently to the full range of the continuum and deeply abide within the practice at some point, effortlessly. Effortlessly. So thank you for tonight. And if you'll just sit for a minute or two, if we'll just sit for a couple of minutes together, then we'll have some questions. So if you have any questions or comments, I'd be happy to take them. I didn't feel like I was connecting somehow. Perhaps I was just, perhaps it was too abstract of a talk. I don't know. But if you'd like to have any points of clarity or just a more explanation, please feel free to ask. Yes, in the back. Yes.
What I've come to is that what I was considering mindfulness was actually the visceral kind of thought process.
Yes. Yes, exactly. Right. Yes.
And in doing that, I create, almost like an analogy of a movie, I create the distance between what's happening.
Yes, exactly. Very good. Right.
I come to the conclusion that I'm in the way.
Yes, good, beautiful. Beautiful. Very nice. Yes. You can't get out of the way. Okay, so the very nice question. The question had to do with his beginning to perceive that there is a visceral, subtle thinking that he had equated as being mindful, which was actually blocking the mindfulness, and that when he saw the thinking as blocking the mindfulness, he then tried to get out of the way or get the thinking out of the way, which was impossible, right? It is impossible because that which is trying to control the mind is the mind. In other words, seeing the subtle forms of thought, which you have which you have taken to be mindfulness, which have just been a commentary upon what you're seeing, and then you're seeing that, and then you're assuming another visceral reaction or thinking process to the initial obscuration, and then so it's a thought trying to battle a thought, really. You can't win that way. The mind can't think itself out of thinking. All it can do is see the thinking. Hearing the thought is enough. There's nothing you need to do about thinking. except knowing that thought is arising. You see, what you're learning is how to relinquish your objection to things and have faith that awareness is enough. Just seeing is enough. There's nothing else that needs to be added except the seeing. The seeing is enough. The seeing, ultimately, has no fear behind it. And any subtle commentary is just subtle thinking about a placement or a fixed response to what is being seen. That's what's necessary, is to be even quieter when we realize that a commentary is carrying forth. To be even quieter. The seeing is enough. Thank you for that. Anyone else? Yes, in the back. Yes. Yes.
And I feel thrilled that I'm seeing the stories instead of just acting on
them. Yes, beautiful.
And I'm really enjoying seeing that I want to blame somebody and working with that human children thing and trying to drop the story.
Yes. Yes.
So I don't need to be any better than where I am right now.
No, no, you didn't hear that from me, did you? No, I appreciate that. This woman is from a Christian background, and she's hearing in my talk that there is more yet to accomplish. And that has stimulated her desire to move beyond what she is enjoying it within the practice right now, which is seeing the limitation of her blame and seeing cutting through some of her stories and all beautiful practice. Part of it may be a Christian cultural thing, but part of it is just a cultural thing entirely, because when we hear that there's more or deeper or more subtle, we think, well, how do I get there? And we try to bring ourselves along. It's difficult for me to teach to the wide variety of experience that's out there. And I realize that that's one of the real slippery slopes that many of us are on. We're ambitious in our meditation. Isn't it sufficient to enjoy what you're doing now in your spiritual practice and how it's really supporting you, and you're expressing many of the factors within what you're already doing. The joy of it. Mm-hmm. So you're no longer caught. The joy of it comes from the impersonal quality, that you're no longer identified with some of those very strongly conditioned patterns. But then we think, well, that's not enough. I'm not doing something. The whole thing is a natural unfolding. We can't get there by ambition. You get there by enjoying and seeing just where you are. That enjoying and seeing will deepen on its own through your enjoyment of the seeing. So if you want to do something, enjoy it even more. Love what you're seeing. See the beauty of it. See the joy of what you're... And let your heart feel the fullness of the truth of what you're doing. Okay? Now, stay there, because the faith in what I just said is all that's necessary for a deep abiding. Having faith that what you're doing is sufficient without bringing forth any ambition of what you are lacking or needing. The seeing is enough. The enjoying is enough. There was a hand in the back. Anyone? Yes. Yes, going up and down, yes.
And on a retreat that you were talking that I should maybe consider not quitting when I was driven by this control, ambition, the forceful kind of sitting, and I really related to that. I'm having trouble getting back into a regular practice at all now. I feel really at sea about, and I see the phrase here in the homework, effortless and natural, and I feel very far from that. Is there any
Yes, yes. The question is, she gets caught in the controlling aspects of mindfulness, and she's read the homework where it talks about the natural and ease of organic mindfulness, and she's wondering how to access that natural mindfulness. Okay, so we're going to bring forth another factor. Shannon, wherever you are. Okay. But we're bringing forth another factor here to encourage the naturalness, okay? So mindfulness isn't necessarily the factor that, the door that invites you. Okay, remember I said that we usually, our personalities usually select a different door. So the door that might be your door in is interest. Now, I know you have children, and hopefully there's an interest in your children. And an interest in your relationship for your children, and an interest in what you, the conditioning you're communicating to your children, for your children, right? And all of that, and the values you're giving them, the ethics, everything. There's the whole of the practice. If you can enter the door of your maternal love for your child and see what it is and how it is that you can increase the relationship and the intimacy between you and your child through the natural interest of maternal love, and bring forth those qualities that you most want your child to assume in yourself. Now, that's just one door of interest. Interest really means, where are you interested in life? Go there, and where you're interested, you're also most attentive. So mindfulness is going to come through the door of interest if you do it right. Rather than doing it absent-mindedly, hopefully when you're interested in something, you'll be wide awake, alive within that interest. Therefore, there's mindfulness. And the other factors will also come through that door. So you can generate your mindfulness not through the disciplined approach of being away from your children, sitting 45 minutes a day while your children are screaming for attention, but through the very interaction with your children itself. Okay? So look at interest as your door through. There are six others, so we could go all night. But I'm trying to show you that each factor has a way to enhance all the other factors through it. And discipline, just the discipline rigor of sitting hour after hour may not be what's the most inviting to your heart. It doesn't mean that you failed the practice. It means the practice has failed you. You have to find the right door to make the practice work for you. And there will be that door. Okay, good, yeah. Anybody want to try another door? Yes.
So I'm wondering, because I
know that, you know, they're keeping their breathing and everything. Really?
So fatigue, sleepiness?
Yeah.
Sleepiness, yeah. Sleepiness, the question is about sleepiness and seeming the interference of sleepiness to your disciplined sitting. Is that, mm-hmm. that right? One is the fatigue factor. We have to be very careful. You can't run on all cylinders in all directions and expect to have any energy left for the practice. There has to be a prioritization. And therefore a renunciation of some of the ways that we create discord and speed in our life that creates the inevitable fatigue factor. Most often fatigue is in trying to do too much too quickly with too little. And instead of that, spend some time reflecting on what you really want out of life. Even if you write down a list of priorities for yourself. And I'm not suggesting pretending to put spiritual discipline at the top of the list just because you think you should. No shoulding in this. What is it really? And then ask yourself, of the things I've listed, what wouldn't be enhanced by paying more attention to it? And then, if you really want those things, and you want the most out of those things, you see what road you have to travel in order for that to happen. What wouldn't be enhanced by your paying attention, by your ability to listen? And connect. Mostly speed does just the opposite. It gives us the thrill of having done something, but the blur of not seeing anything of what we're doing. We know somehow, unconsciously, that we just did something. But we have no idea what the details or impact or the effect on us was at all, except in residue by the fatigue. So you begin to think, oh, wait a second here. I'm missing this thing. I'm missing the experience of what is most precious in my life. How can I regain the experience back so I can live what's most precious in my life? Go that way and see if you can wake up your life through that which is your top priority. Rather than trying to assert your top priority being spiritual. That doesn't mean anything. What does it mean to be spiritual? Being spiritual simply means being awake, alive to what you're doing. So go that way. Bring the aliveness into what you're doing rather than to rank spirituality over what you're doing. You see? Infuse it with the aliveness it deserves. Yes.
I was thinking about mindfulness. I always have to connect it with compassion because that means also self-realization. And that means seeing the whole picture. And I need to go there with compassion. Because that means that includes everything. It includes pain. It includes joy.
Right. Now listen to your door because you're describing the door of your journey. You're describing this, right? Okay? So your journey is the journey through the door of the heart. The door of being affected, right? Being affected with an A. Affected. Is that right? Mm-hmm. She's a good question. Just let me state the question. The question was that she feels that compassion is that none of this really makes much sense to her without compassion, without the ability to see the comprehension, the clarity of everything, and to bring that affection into the clarity and embrace of everything. Mm-hmm. Did I state it right? The Buddha did not just talk about sati, S-A-T-I, which is interpreted as awareness or mindfulness. He talked about sati sampajana, awareness and clear comprehension. Awareness on its own can be very dry. It just sees what's there. It's just this, just that seeing. Sampajana is taking in the full comprehension of the circumstances and context of what is occurring. So you don't, for instance, you see somebody and they say, well, how do you think I look today? And you say, I don't like your dress. Or I think you look heavy. Well, that's mindfulness shows you that and the words come out. But that's not the heart, is it? The context of being able to say it so that it's not offensive, so that the person can hear it, so that it's the right timing, so that you're saying things so that somebody can hear what you're saying if they even need to hear it at all. And yet holding yourself to being able to say just what is true and perhaps not making a false comment or saying something that, well, you look nice when you don't, but finding some way to bring forth what the person is asking for in a way that the person can hear and it helps the other person. See, that's the context of the heart. That's the compassion element of the clarity of just what you've seen. And you can see that with unless the practice has the context, then the sword of what you say can be as hurtful and as detrimental as anything. So you stick with the comprehension. Work to saying, to looking, to feeling the effects of the world and what the world needs, the context as well as the truth of what's before your eyes. And you work it that way. And your heart will just grow in response to that. Okay for tonight? Okay, thank you very much.